You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Fantastic. So the way this works is I will do a poem and then formally introduce our guest, but I feel like that was more exciting than anything I could do. So we're just going to do it now. Can we please say hello and welcome to the stage, Luca Lesson. It is a joy to have you here. I will do a poem and then I will say hello to you because it's been a while since we've spoken and I'm really excited to get into this. So as I mentioned before, the format's going to be something old, something new, something borrowed and something blue. My something old is from Greenbelt turning 40 a few years ago and they asked me to write something on the theme of home. And I think, again, because I've sort of grown up with this festival, it's something I've got lots of memories attached to. So I'd like to read the poem I wrote for them, and then we will share our guest with you too. Home is where the art is. Home is where you can be open-hearted. Home is where your soul goes to recharge. It is cathartic. Home is age 17, putting your mate Luke down as hype man in your band. Because it's the only way you know to get him a ticket. It is him joining you on stage and shutting every song down because that boy is nothing if not committed. Home is where the past is. Home is being the only person tuned into your brother's channel at the silent disco. While 99% of the rest of the tent are singing along to ABBA, he plays Dizzy Rascal's I Love You and you are so happy you might cry. Home is where there's always room for dancing. Home is changing into yellow tights in a stranger's caravan and being given a piggyback across the mud before your first ever solo performance. Home is where your potential is harnessed. Home is where safe doesn't always mean the same as guarded. Home is when you start booking poets for Woke and Spurred, feeling the need to say it's a Christian festival, but don't worry, it's not like that. 10 years later, it speaks for itself. You just add it's one of the best poetry crowds you will ever have. Home is where you spend the hours grafting. Home is fighting to stay awake, driving from Edinburgh to Kettering after 3 years of performing together with Chris in a basement / dungeon. The next day when you play main stage and they all sing your words back to you, you wonder for a moment if you've actually crashed and died and have gone to heaven. Home is where you celebrate the harvest. Home is coming back last year, feeling the lowest you have felt, and before you've even started, simply knowing you'll be held. Home is where the light outshines the shadows life is casting. Home is where after a heady mix of fate and crazy goats, you let your guard down for long enough to share a first kiss for the second time. You wake up the next morning wondering if you dreamt the whole thing, mainly because you've been dreaming about it for the last 2.5 years. When you join her for breakfast the next morning with her friends and entire extended family, she plays it so cool, it will convince you that you have. It is only on your way to the main site, she locks her little finger around yours. And you know, the rest of your life will never be the same again. Home is where there's always second chances. Home is a Monday night lift from a friend all the way back to Margate, leading to what is possibly the most delicious nap you have ever had. Home is where it sometimes hits the hardest. Home is where you're welcomed in regardless. Home is where we're only getting started. Thank you so much to all of you being at home with us here, my homies. Can we welcome to the stage a fantastic poet from all the way around the world, joining us from Australia, the wonderful Luca Lesson. Luca, if you're up for it, could you share something old with us and then I will ask you some questions and we'll have a chat?
Yes, this poem is for my grandmother that I wrote many years ago and she's since passed, so it's even more special every time I get to perform at it. It's an invocation. So this is for my yaya that we say in Greek for grandmother. My grandmother grew up between two wars in Greece. She lost her brother, Christo, to the Germans and named my mother, Christina, after him. Rare for a Greek woman, she had a divorce at 50 and has lived for 30 years with his photo still in the spare room. She's a green thumb. She drinks cordial from her own mandarines, drinks tea from my own chamomile bush, and picks tomatoes whenever I say to her, yeah, I feel like a salata, she hardly went to school. But one day, when discussing all the time that I've spent studying at university and admiring all three different types of basil she has growing in her garden, she says to me, Luca, eat two leaves basil every day. Good for the blood, good for the brain. They don't teach that at university. And when my brother Ilya says to her, you know, you're really smart. You really know a lot. She'd always reply, yes, Ilya, I'm very education. So one day I decide to ask my grandmother about racism and whether it's okay for Greeks to still hate the Turks for what they did to us in the past. And she says, racism? No, just because some people naughty doesn't mean you throw the rest in the rubbish. Her name is Katarina Batunas, but her maiden name was Sarandavgas. And Sarandavgas literally means 40 eggs. And as the story goes, one of my great-grandfathers was challenged by another villager to see if he can eat an omelette made entirely with 40 eggs without getting sick. And anyone who knows my appetite will know I am very proud to say he won that bet. And so the nickname, Mr. 40 Eggs, hey, Mr. 40 Eggs, then got turned into the family name and was passed down the generations to my yaya. And today, it's her birthday. So I say what we always do. Naikatastisis, yaya. May you live to 100. But she's 83, so instead of thanking me, she says, 100? God, man, no thank you. Maybe a couple more years, then I go to sleep. Why are you going to go to sleep, yaya? Because I'm tired. I had enough. Where are you going to go to sleep, yaya? In the cemetery. I already buy a little house there. Until then, she'll keep stopping us from doing the dishes every time she cooks us a meal. She'll keep calling me to see if I'm too cold when I'm visiting Melbourne. She'll keep trying to slip me a $50 note every time I visit. And she'll keep telling me, Luca, eat two leaves basil every day. Good for the blood. Good for the brain. They don't teach you that at university.
Thank you so, so much. I guess on that note, one thing I would like to ask is, how do poems change over time for you? Because I had a moment when I looked back through my first collection of poetry, that some of it I wrote as a teenager, a lot of it I still believe in my core, but some of it doesn't quite sit with who I am now. And there was a real temptation to go back and update it or almost do these kind of remixes. Whereas then I've sort of, where I landed with it was seeing this is a snapshot of those moments in time, and actually to perform those poems is to go back to that moment and to kind of honor it. And I guess, like you said, with that poem, it's got a completely different meaning now.
Yeah, I think as performance poets as well, it's a really big question, because we really embody our poetry, you know, like it has to move through the body for it to be presented. And so I guess on a practical level, for instance, for that poem, I have performed it in the past where I use the past tense for her. And I have like updated it that she is gone. And then the ending is a little bit different because I talk about how, yeah, now we stay strong kind of thing without her, but it never really stuck. And I kind of like just reliving it the way that it was written. I wrote it the day, you know, it was her birthday, and I performed it that night, and I get to bring her back to life with it rather than try and do the updating so much. Some poems have maybe political or social references that don't last the test of time. And sometimes that needs a change. You know, what is the current version of that social commentary or social issue? That's also something that might happen. But in these both these instances, we're talking about, say, 5-10% change to the poem, and then, you know, rememorizing and having, you know, these versions that end up outdating each other type thing. But I do have a poem that I won the Australian Poetry Slam with, ironically, That is the only poem that I have retired, that I no longer perform anymore, because it was a poem about a really heavy breakup. And it's a poem, it's called The Confluence. You can check it out online, but I don't perform it anymore. It's called The Confluence. It's about two people coming together and becoming one, like two rivers coming together, becoming one. And then when you break up, you feel like half of a person. And I ended up retiring it because every time I had to perform it, it was still too viscerally connected, you know, to my, I hadn't had a break basically from the breakup to performing it, to winning the National Slam, to people going, do that poem like all the time. And so I completely have retired that poem. I don't perform it anymore. And when I do, it's a really rare occasion. And that feels great.
I found that with slams in particular, because you're going head to head in your performance with other people, and because it is often the most emotive and heartfelt poetry that kind of gets higher scores than those things, it feels like people have to take themselves back to those places. And especially if you're performing and talking about a traumatic event in your life, one, it feels absurd to do that and for someone else to be like 7.5 out of 10, but also to kind of like have to like raise it each time against other people and to be like, oh, you know what, that performance wasn't as strong because I didn't really like take myself to the sunken place. And I feel like there's, I found it interesting, I judged a university slam this year, and it felt like there was an awareness of that, where they had a sort of essentially an on-site counselor for people to sort of talk to afterwards, because there never used to be any kind of aftercare with it. But I think I, one of my poems that, that again, I like won these slams with Paper People, in it I mentioned that my grandparents had been praying for me every day of my life. And so I used to update that to say, so that is 7,892 days of someone checking in on me. And then I used to think, I will change that every time I perform, because the poem is the same, the heart is the same, but that specific detail is just growing and adding each time and becoming this more and more incredible thing. And then what would happen is that I would get to a gig and I would sort of have forgotten to check how many days old I was. So I just sort of add another 20 or so since I last did it. So I was kind of aging more rapidly in the poem than in real life. And at some, every now and then I have to sort of course correct and reset it. But then when my grandpa died, that was the moment I decided to pause it on that number, because even though my grandma is still praying for me, even though I sort of have this feeling and hope that he's still there sort of looking out for me, it felt like, oh, okay, that is that poem reaching its final form almost, and kind of paying homage to that. And I think there's other poems that I have definitely rested, if not retired, because it feels like my heart's not in it in the same way. And then having given it space, maybe I can come back to it and have a different kind of sense with it. Although I will say this, on the theme of the Australian Slam, I, for a brief moment, I think because I did an interview with an Australian sort of online newspaper where I talked about winning the National Slam, that got misconstrued. So for a while, I would say I am at the level of famous where I have a Wikipedia page, but it's not regularly updated. And because of that, on my Wikipedia page for a while, it said that I was the Australian National Poetry Slam champion. So much so that when I did like an interview in London on the radio, someone said, oh, so how are you the Australian national champion? And I just had to sort of say, through misinformation and lies. But, you That's, know, so
sounds
even
sounds like the best way to win a slam ever, actually.
Exactly, exactly. But
that's was, the no, that's the no fly zone version.
Exactly. were slams part of your route into performing? Was it something you got into once you were already writing and performing? How was that on your journey?
Yeah, that's great. First of all, I want to say that's really beautiful what you're saying about your grandfather and the prayers and the days. I really love that. And yeah, thanks for sharing that. That's really nice to hear, because these things that we tussle with are living things, you know, these poems, like they really yeah, people sometimes don't really realize. And also I want to mention that when it comes to performing poems that no longer have like the resonance or the emotional charge that first they first had, I try to reconnect with the poem in a new way as I am in the moment right now, rather than try and like recreate my heartbreak from many years ago or whatever else and try and be present with them. But yes, to answer your question, I started writing rap first. I started writing bad hip hop songs with my friend who was the head of the hip hop society at my university, first year out of high school, first or second year university. We would pass notes back and forth to each other, which were rhyming basically raps, but he would write a line and then I would have to rhyme with it. And then I'd, you know, he'd write a line back. And that's how we procrastinated from actually focusing in an anthropology lecture at university. And then I discovered this thing called slam poetry online through Def Jam poetry, which was hosted by Mos Def, a TV show that was on HBO in the United States, for those who haven't seen it. It just blew me away. I was just in absolute awe and in love with this idea that someone could turn up on stage. Everyone can have a judgment of what they look like based on, you know, like who they are based on what they look like, what they're wearing, whatever. And then after 2 minutes, they can just like dispel everybody's ideas and the crowd is on their feet. And it's, for me, I was just like, wow, that is raw and magic. And that's what I have to do. And I entered my first poetry slams by using my rap verses a cappella. And I came third in the first thing that I went in. And that was like a very good sign. And I just went from there. And actually, my grandmother poem that I just performed is one of the first things that I did intentionally that doesn't rhyme, because for me, it's like much easier to rhyme, or I feel much more comfortable to rhyme. And I had to really push myself to hang a poem just on cadence and, you know, tone and rhythm, and that could be as long or as short as I wanted it to be, and, you know, no rhyming at all, and not adhering to a 4-4 rhythm. And since then, I just see everything I do as poetry, and I take the subject matter that usually informs me, or the emotion that usually informs which form it's going to take for me. But yeah, that's how I kind of got into it.
I think I had a similar thing of writing, well, basically bad rap to begin with, but that idea of writing to music, there was such an inherent rhythm and structure there. So again, even like some of my earlier poems, it's 16 bars and a chorus. And like you say, I feel so much more comfortable with rhyme, partly because I think when you get a really tight rhyming couplet, like, you know, that's done, you know, that that particular line works. Whereas I found that when you're writing more free verse or that kind of thing, you can just always like change a word or something like that. So that sense of like, how do I know when it's done, yeah, became such a learning curve for me, because again, it was driven more by the feeling of it than necessarily the technicality. And I think I love that I started out that way, because I think a lot of that still comes through naturally. Likewise, in your work, there's an inherent sort of rhythm and cadence to it. But I think it took a while for me to trust that these poems could kind of exists without having to be so rigid to a structure, or that structure is really helpful as a guide, because you can then break out of it if you want to. So now I kind of love coming in and out of it. But I guess on that note, you're up for me doing something new?
Yes.
Because this,
yeah, let's do it,
is, well, I guess this is structured but not quite rhymey, so it's kind of part of that evolution as well. And this is the first poem that I wrote since my son was born that isn't about my son. And it took me quite a while to get there because I'm completely obsessed. And I wrote it for Valentine's Day this year. And it is a love poem, but specifically a love poem for my friends, because romantic love gets a lot of a lot of days, a lot of celebration, and I wanted to try and celebrate them in the same way. And my way of writing it, which I'd recommend to sort of anyone as an exercise, was I just sort of made a list of my friends in my head and then made a list of things I liked about them and then combined all of those friends together into a sort of Transformers-style mega friends and then wrote a poem about that. So I think I can do it off by heart, but I'm just going to get it up here just in case. And so if halfway through I look at this, it's not because I'm getting a text. It's because I'm lacking in confidence. I love that you say yes to things without asking for details. I love that most people think you are normal, but I happen to know the truth. I love that you are physically incapable of whispering. I love that you buy me books that make you cry because you know that I'll cry too. I love that you went from being my wife's friends to our friends to my friends. That you don't have a real job either, so we get to hang out midweek. The ridiculous things don't just happen to you, but through you. That even sitting in silence with you is nourishing for my soul. I love that you love crisps as much as I do. That you love therapy as much as I do. That you love life as much as I do. How little you care what people think. How much you care how people feel. How much you laugh at your own jokes. How easily we pick up where we left off. How when you ask me how I am doing, you mean it. How we had the hard conversation and it was worth it. How occasionally you realize just how brilliant you are. How when I see the time is 12:34, I always think of you. I love that none of these are even close to the most obvious things about you. That this list started off twice as long and could have been longer still. That I haven't mentioned your kindness or your thoughtfulness or how much my heart lifts when you enter a room. And even without any of the above, I would still feel lucky to be friends with you. I love that we're mostly good at telling each other. I also love that I get to make sure. I love that I get to call you my friend. And I love that I get to be yours. Thank you. I partly wanted to do that because I know you've got this new play show about, well, called Agape and Other Types of Love. So I wanted to ask you about that. But do you want to do something new first?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to do. So it's so good. Yes, I'll do the poem, which is called Agape, which is based on the ultimate form of love. Agape lives in every piece of dirt on the earth. The cells in the universe, our lashes and our lips and our skins and the moments of our births. Agape's in the sea, the whale to the pearl, the waves as they curl, the winds as they whirl, as butterflies emerge, the ferns they unfurl, the colors of the birds and the rivers as they merge, the singing of a dirge, Athena's owl sitting on her perch, the lost child returned. Agape is the word. Have you heard? Agape is the surge in the isthmus, our chance of resistance, a chance at existence, the stitches in the blankets that warm us in the winters, everything we are in an instant, it's in all that is and everything that isn't. The journey through our hearts on a search for forgiveness, the black sheep of the herd, the frankincense and myrrh, the blessings within the curses, those lessons we are yet to learn. Agape's in the star that directs every sailor towards their true north oceans. Those spirals we find in our quiet conversations, the building blocks of us, the stuff that makes us up, the cells in our blood, the love that makes us love everything below and above. Everything below and above made of love. Agape's in the mending of a bone that's been broken. The instinct to heal that exists in all our open wounds that we've suffered, but now we hardly remember. Agape's the bridge between our pains and our pleasures, the seed in the desert waiting on a change in the weather, a love between the book and professor, loose change and beggar, survival and surrender, the splendor of a sunset on the last day of December. All that you cannot see, you begrudge. All that's dying in the dust, everything we tried to trust, everything they say to hate is still made of this kind of love. All that's real or fake, from the pigeon to the dove. New shoot gonna grow when you cut that tree. Enemies become friends when they find a bigger enemy. The universe twists and bends according to destiny, fueled by an energy that goes beyond you and me. We hang in the balance of gravity. We gravitate to each other based on a luminosity. We orbit around the sun because he's the one shining. When we shine with a guppy, when you shine with a guppy, love becomes reality.
Thank you so much. You mentioned it slightly before, this idea that everything you do is poetry and it's just kind of getting a sense of which form it wants to come out in. And obviously there's such a kind of rhythm and musicality to even that piece. But how is it for you creating something more longer form? Do you see it as a series of set pieces or as kind of one big thing that's all building up to each other, I guess?
As in creating like a solo show like this one?
Yeah.
That poem's from? Yeah. It's awesome, man. It's such a challenge because what I would do as a rapper, often as a rapper, at least in the early days, I think, and as a young man, not just as a rapper, but we're like just trying to show off. And so there's like a lot of, you know, fast raps or like super dense, you know, structures and, you know, multi-layered, multi-syllable, all sorts of things. But with a show like this, which is 19 poems from start to finish, the narrative is more important than showing off. And so I want to show what I can do, but I also want to continue and progress the narrative at the same time. And I can sometimes sacrifice the narrative to do something interesting, but you can't do that all the time. That can only happen, you know, a couple of times throughout the whole show. The most important thing is that not only is it a solo piece of theater, musical theater, I guess you could say, but it's a one long memorized 60 to 70 minute poem separated into many different scenes. And that needs to be, you know, it's a love story across time, this show. So, you know, there's Socrates and Diotima in ancient Greece at Plato's symposium. Socrates is sharing this story about how he learned everything he knows about love from Diotima, who's a real ancient figure that he really does say that in the symposium, but she doesn't get much of a look in the symposium. She's not there. And so I decided to bring her to life and make it that they were lovers, because how else could Socrates learn about love from this ancient figure? And then I flip between the ancient world to the modern world, where there's reincarnations of Socrates and Diotima in the midst of a riot in the city of Athens in modern times, with a, you know, economic crisis and other things going on. And they start a dialogue about the loves as well. And so they're living out the same lives again, basically. And so it's complex. There's characters, there's all these things going on. Socrates raps, you know, like I need to make sure that the whole thing makes sense. And so that's the biggest thing I think about creating a long form thing, that it's not, that I have to make sure that the narrative is tight and that no one's getting lost. And I'm also showing off to some capacity.
But I found that particularly because I got into writing through these slams where you had 3 minutes to win over the audience. So it felt like every individual poem had to do everything. It had to be a bit funny to get people to put their guards down, and then a bit impressive in terms of the wordplay, and then a bit heartfelt and meaningful towards the end, and then kind of wrap up neatly so that you've given them everything in that short burst for them to be able to take away. And it was, for a long time, even when I wasn't doing slams anymore, I saw all of my poems as standalone individual pieces. Like, this is my thoughts on this one thing. I have to get everything in there. And it's been really interesting more recently. Well, with my next book, it's the first time that all the poems are on this same theme. So they're all poems from the early days of my son's life, but suddenly it feels like not every poem has to do everything. So you can have poems that are just out and out abstract and confusing, and you can have poems that are more heartfelt, and you can have poems that are more funny. And I guess the same way that I would normally build all of those elements into one single poem, you're building all of them into this much wider project. But that means that the individual elements are allowed to kind of exist in their own way. And I think, like, you know, you kind of describe the whole thing as one long poem rather than this kind of set list that you're coming in and out of. And I think that's really interesting because that's also such a bigger feeling to leave people with. And I guess one question is, when the whole thing is, you know, 60, 70 minutes that's scripted, do you feel like you're performing it like a poem, or does it feel more like you're acting out a play that you're in? Because it's still coming from you. It's still a kind of solo show. Is there a difference between when you're going in and out of these 19 poems, do you feel like you're flicking a switch, or are you in that zone for the whole thing?
In the zone for the whole thing. I think it's a natural progression for me. I think most performance poets don't realize that they're actually great. A great performance poet is a great actor because many of their poems are personal, but each poem is a different facet of who they are, in a sense. And to perform them properly, then if you're performing poetry for a long time over time, and you're performing regularly, and you've written many poems that hold onto a different facet of experience of human nature, then you are training yourself constantly to be able to come into contact with very nuanced shades of human experience. And that, and every word, you know, like as a performer, as you know, I've seen your work, obviously, you know, just the way you drop a certain word, you know, the tone that lands in the right moment, in the right time, in the right venue, with the right sound and the, you know, the right sequence of poems, and everything's building up, and then you drop this one line and it just, like, it reverberates, you know, and the space in between the lines and the jokes in between the poems, and like everything is such a huge training of acting, and you probably don't really realize. And I didn't really realize until I realized that I really wanted to push out of Slam. I won the Slam, and the last thing I wanted to do is just keep writing 2 or 3 minute poems. I wanted to challenge myself. And I ended up doing something very random, which was a master's of sound design. But person who supervised it allowed me to use poetry or performance poetry as the sound. So my outcome was literally like a solo theater poetry thing. Well, we didn't have a name for it. And so now I still don't have a name for it. I have to have a name for it to explain it to audiences. Like, what am I doing? And I say something like a poetic hip hop theater show based on the ancient Greek types of love. But really, it's, you know, like, how long can the box be before it's not a box anymore? So it's just me doing my thing in the way that I love. And I created this thing. Actually, the nucleus of it happened during the pandemic, which makes a lot of sense because I was so grounded that it ended up being like, I really integrated all these different facets of who I am into this one thing. So it's political, it's full of love, it's rap, it's spoken word, it's theater, it's just everything that I am in one show, like everything that I could possibly do, except for, you know, acrobatics and ballroom dancing. It's literally everything that I am. And so I think that it is one body of work. I am me. I'm not playing a character necessarily, but I'm a storyteller, and the storyteller is, you know, saying the words of Socrates, you know, explaining what Socrates said at the symposium. And so he goes into that world when he plays that character, I guess. But, you know, it's just so enjoyable to push yourself as an artist. And I think poets make great, just like poets make great novelists, I think poets, performance poets, can also make great theater makers.
Definitely. I think I was really hesitant about thinking of it as acting to begin with, because I didn't want to feel like I was trying to pretend or trying to manipulate people, but the more I've gone on the, like you say, the ability to kind of tap into these different parts of yourself, and even in reading other people's poetry, being able to embody that as well. And I think it was just because at school I was very bad at drama and acting, because it was, you know, doing Shakespeare and that kind of thing, and I just didn't know how to sort of tell my face to look sad or whatever it was. Whereas I think when you're connected to the work and when you're feeling it, because that truth is inherent in what you're doing, it then means that whether or not you're accentuating that, it becomes a part of the kind of extension of that expression of the work and of who you are.
Yeah. I've never acted out anybody else's words. Let me put it that way. You know, like, yes, I've read other people's poems. I don't do it very often, but that is a big difference, that these things that we're creating have come from us, and we're on stage, you know, performing them in the best way that we can. So there's a visceral connection there that can never be tainted, you know, can never be removed. Sometimes I perform and I get off stage and people are like, did you write all that? Because I'm realizing that these days it's not that common for actors or performers or even rappers to necessarily write their own work, which is, to me, it's extremely important. And if I had to choose, I think I love the writing 1% more than the performing. If I had to choose for the rest of my life, I could only do one of them, I think I'd prefer to just write my own work than perform someone else's work for the rest of my life, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah, yes. all that stuff plays into it for sure.
So on that note, I'm going to read someone else's poem.
Yes.
And I was trying to work out who to do, and I realized there's an Australian poet and writer and cartoonist, Michael Lunig, who has just got a short poem that I love, and he came to Greenbelt a few years ago and was able to see him here. So this is simply called The Joy of Missing Out. Oh, the joy of missing out, when the world begins to shout and rush towards that shining thing, the latest bit of metal bling, trying to have it, see it, do it. You simply know you won't go through it. The anxious clamoring and need, this restless, hungry thing to feed. Instead, you feel the loveliness, the pleasure of your emptiness. You spurn the treasure on the shelf in favor of your peaceful self, without regret, without a doubt, oh, the joy of missing out. Thank you. Are you up for sharing something borrowed as well?
I am. I'm up for sharing something borrowed because I have this poem that I wrote a while ago that half of it is completely and clearly, honestly, overtly stolen. And I think that it's a good one to share. So this one is called Subcomandante Marcos. The sun barely rose on New Year's Day, 1994, in San Cristobal. But when it did, it looked just like the head of a shovel peeking over the ridge. And the night before, the crescent moon looked exactly like the head of a pick that a farmer had just placed on the stars. That night, a battalion of peasants called the Zapatistas, in bandanas and pistolas, were marching in through Las Chapas with a declaration of war. People were drunk and still slow dancing with the year before when they arrived, and by the time they took over, the streets were littered with just missed kisses and spilt memories. Subcomandante Marcos was with them, always dressed in fatigues, face in a balaclava, eyes that could cut concrete and a pipe dripping from his lips. He called himself Subcomandante, the sub-commander, for a reason, because his leaders were the people, and together they were powerful. And from that night onwards, the government would try anything to stop them. Things got bloody quickly, but along with murder and violence, the media was the greatest weapon the government had, and in a Catholic and homophobic Mexico, they decided to start a rumor that no self-respecting revolutionary could ever recover from. They started to spread the headline that Subcomandante Marcos is gay. They called him a sexual pervert, a pendejo, and he responded without hesitation and as every rebel should, with a poem. He wrote, "Yes, Marcos is gay. Marcos is gay in San Francisco, black in South Africa, an Asian in Europe, a Chicano in San Isidro, anarquista in España, Palestino in Israel, a Jew in Nazi Germany, indigenous in the streets of San Cristobal, a whistleblower stuck in the Department of Defense, a feminist in any political party, a communist in the Cold War, a pacifist in Bosnia, Mapuche in Los Andes, an artist without a gallery or portfolio, a housewife at home alone on a Saturday night, a sexist in the feminist movement, a woman riding the subway by herself at 10 p.m., un campesino sin tierra, a peasant without land, an unemployed worker, a doctor without plasma, a dissident in neoliberalism, a writer without books or readers, and yes, a Zapatista in Southeast Mexico. This is Marcos." And in this neoliberal state we call the lucky country, there is something that we can all learn from Marcos. As domestic violence victims with no services, as Aboriginal sports stars throwing imaginary spears, as a Chinese worker in Ballarat during the gold rush, a farmer without crops, an indigenous person that they stole the farmland from, the London street kid forced onto a boat in 1788, a Muslim family trying to build a mosque on the Gold Coast, a feminist in any political party, a lonely spoken word poet at a pompous writers' festival, an asylum seeker being used as a chess piece for successive governments again and again, and for a gay couple who've been in love and engaged for a decade but are just waiting for one simple law to change. And yes, if Marcos is gay, then so am I.
Thank you so, so much. I'm aware we had to start a bit late, so I'm going to sort of move us on to the last section. But thank you so, so much for joining us, for your generous poetry and your chat. Brilliant. And here's hoping we can do this again soon. The last section is Something Blue, which I like because that's up for kind of many different kinds of interpretation. I don't know if anyone was here yesterday. I took blue to be a sort of heartfelt poem about my uncle, and our guest took blue to be sort of as rude as physically possible. But because I've sort of done this format almost 50 times now, very early on, I used up all of my poems that actually had blue things in. But for this, I was trying to think what I wanted to share. And I realized that almost 10 years ago, I visited Australia and New Zealand, and I've not been able to go back since, and I really hope I can at some point soon. But part of that trip, I had just finished university. I was just trying to figure out if I could sort of be a poet full time, what that might look like. And when I was in New Zealand, I had friends who were working for an advertising agency there who sort of said, slam poetry is this like really cool, exciting thing. How can we use it to sell stuff? And specifically, they were like, let's try and find the most boring thing we can. Can you write a cool rap about compound interest? And I said, no, I can't. But one of the other things they had was just one of their clients was sort of like had like made milk, basically. And I was still wrestling with sort of poetry and advertising. And at the time, it was quite a big debate in the UK. But I sort of thought, this isn't me like advertising a specific sort of brand or product. This is just me sort of the concept of milk, which feels kind of harmless enough. 10 years on, I'm not sure how I feel about the sort of dairy industry, and I don't want to be the poster boy for milk. However, it was a learning curve in terms of what it means to writing to a brief, especially when there's sort of legal ramifications. So the first one I wrote was just this list, almost like a slam poem, as if I was sort of milk laying it down to all the other drinks. And I was like, you don't know about how much calcium I've got, all of this kind of stuff. And just got these series of notes back saying like, we can't actually prove that milk helps your teeth sort of maybe whiter. And so it ended up, the poem that I want to share was as quickly as possible pivoting away from what it was meant to be about. So the first two lines are me just sort of really shoehorning into writing a poem about smiling, but I have to mention milk in this. It's very subtle. You might not notice it, but I just, for the really keen eared amongst you, you'll see it, how I managed to just write about something I wanted to write about. It's a known fact that milk helps for healthy teeth to grow. So I dedicate this to those who put their teeth on show. I don't just mean the winners. I don't just mean the dreamers. I dedicate this to the grinners. I dedicate this to the beamers. Not that docile, placid, over-practiced, photostatic selfie face. That mildly tilted, slightly stilted, nicely filtered, help me face. I mean that proper smile, could cross the Nile, crocodile wicked grin. That extra fat Cheshire cat lip stretched to max to fit it in. None of that sugar-coated fake that leaves you looking like a mumble crust or insecure lips demure, no fun unless I'm drunk enough. It's that genuine, friendly grin, beckoning to let you in, that totally colon D cannot help but show the teeth. That some at times almost undignified. It may be asymmetric, but you'll see in my eyes I'm still alive and you'll know that I meant it. So you can have your manufactured, packaged, acting, happy selfie style. I'd rather keep it simple, cheeky dimples with a healthy smile. So I handed that into them and they said, we can't actually prove that it is a known fact that milk helps for healthy teeth to grow. So can you change the wording on that as well? So it was just a sort of exercise in realizing I want to just write poems for myself. But it was part of that time of kind of, I've just decided I want to be a poet. Let's try anything and everything. And this felt like an excuse to go back to that place. Would you be up for sharing something blue for us just to really bring it home?
Yes, something blue. I thought a lot about this and I decided that I'm going to share a poem that is for my son. It doesn't mention anything blue in it, but there is a rumor that goes around, especially in the UK, that the ancient Greeks never had a word for blue. And it's completely false. I don't know why it's become like a massive thing. So the ancient word for blue is kianos. And it is also the word for the stone, this precious stone, lapis lazuli, that happens to be the national stone of my wife's country, which is Chile. So my family's Greek. My wife is from Chile, South America. And lapis lazuli is the national stone in Chile. And in ancient Greece, they used the word kianos to describe lapis lazuli, but also things that were blue, the shimmering blue moon, and other things. It's actually mentioned in the Odyssey. That one of the kings, King Alcinous, has a mosaic, a blue mosaic on his wall. And it's used as kianos, the word that's used to describe it. So we named our son Kianos. That's his name. And because you have your child in your life and he's the blue thing in my life, this is a piece that I wrote for him, which is from Agape and Other Kinds of Love, about a family type of love called storgi, which is the love between parents and children, etc. So this is for my son, Kianos. My son, you're just the size of a sesame seed, a grain of sand landing on your ancestor's beach. But I want to take time out to teach you about something called storgi. See, your family's from Athens streets. On your dad's side, at least, a place of philosophy and tragedy, comedy and catastrophe, and phoenixes rising from ashes, and gods and logic and passion and laws and factions and love and all of its distractions, and philotimo and many other things that I'll teach you in good time. But son, though your life has hardly begun, I wanted to teach you of this old concept to help you through the contests of life. Storgi is a kind of love that will hold you and guide you, love, that will feed you and mind you, love, that will teach you to rise above. Storgi is a kind of love that will hold you and guide you, love, that will feed you and mind you, love, that will teach you to rise above. Now you're the size of a pomegranate seed, hanging on the fruit of the family tree. But I want to take time out to teach you, because to teach you is to remind me this love will hold my hand as I hold your hand. Teach me how to teach you and stand beside me as I stand next to you and you take your very first breath. The kind of love that'll make my ma wipe your mouth when you dribble. Make me want to frame your very first scribbles. No matter how hard it gets, I'll still love to hold you and kiss you and forgive you your tantrums. Teach you your ethics and the family anthem. To love and be loved is to fall and be heard, is to heal and move forward with what you have learned. The kind of love that gives shelter from the rain, lifts us out the puddles and the pain. The love that sustains, the love of carers and servants, of being in service to a much greater purpose. Storge is the kind of love that will hold you and guide you, love, that will feed you and mind you, love, that will teach you to rise above. Storge is the kind of love that will hold you and guide you, love, that will feed you and mind you, love, that will teach you to rise above. Now you're the size of a watermelon, shaded by the vine of the goddess and me. But I want to take time out to teach you how love comes back eventually. See, when my time is done and you're all grown up and I'm old and gray and my back is hunched, remember this love, remember this love, my son. When you wipe my mouth as I dribble, try to decipher my very last scribble, finish my sentence, give me medicine, take me on walks and forgive me my madness. This love will hold your hand as you hold my hand, teach you how to teach me and stand beside you as you stand next to me and I take my last breath.
Thank you so, so much. Can we give it up one more time for the fantastic, amazing Luca Lesson? A privilege to have you. Really, really appreciate you.
Thank you.
Thank you, all of you, for coming out, for bearing with us with the technical difficulties at the start. We're all back here 4 p.m. tomorrow with another guest. I'm doing stuff all over the festival, but for now I will hand you back because I know some people want to go and see Lady Danbury. So thank you so much. Much love. See you very soon. Cheers.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.